This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Last month, Donald Trump called Baltimore a rat and rodent infested mess. Those comments came after he told four Democratic lawmakers of color to go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, unquote. Well, they're just the latest examples of an ongoing tactic. The president publicly denigrates women and people of color who oppose him and his policies, and he often delivers these racist remarks on Twitter. What power do words have, and how do they affect communities he attacks? One of the many topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, our recurring series Connecting Culture and Context. Later, we remember the legendary Nobel Prize-winning writer, Toni Morrison, who died last week at the age of 88, and we review two new television shows, Family Reunion and Pose. Joining me for all that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie Bullock-Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark Anthony Neal, the James B. Duke Distinguished Professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. Natalie, Mark, welcome back. Good to have you here.
What's up, Frank?
Here's what's up. We're going to talk about Donald Trump's attacks on four women of color recently elected to Congress. But we have just learned that the president has taken the unprecedented step of recommending that Israel deny entry to that country. He reiterated that in a tweet this morning, that Israel deny entry to that country for two of these American representatives, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. And in fact, Israel's deputy foreign minister confirms they will not be allowed to enter his country. New York Times is reporting this, saying that Trump's decision to recommend another country block entry to two United States citizens, let alone members of Congress, is one of the most pronounced violations of democratic norms that he has engaged in since taking office. Speechless might be a way to respond, but this is a radio show, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Trump presidency 2 years in now is that nothing surprises you anymore. Even as it enrages you, and to willfully criminalize not only your own citizens, but your own legislatures, right? Folks that you're supposed to be in partnership with governing the country, to willingly criminalize them in the way that he did. And you can't imagine that there's any points to be gained from this, from folks who aren't already Donald Trump supporters. It's as if he continuously gives red meat to his base. My fear, and I'm sure many of our fears, is that the fringe of that base will then at some point be empowered to be disruptive in a way that is truly tragic and violent and dangerous.
We've already seen that, haven't we? People quoting Donald Trump, killing people en masse using the guns that they have ready access to, and quoting Donald Trump.
And when targeting they kill people. Right, targeting particular legislatures, and in this case, women of color. Right. It sets an incredibly dangerous precedent. And this is where, you know, you're at the point where Donald Trump now is like, he is who he is. Mitch McConnell, what's your word on this? Right. Mm-hmm. Senior leadership in both the House and the Senate, senior leadership in the White House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. What's your commentary on this?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it strikes me that we're at a moment where Trump's racism, his misogyny, his sexism, which has always been there. It's not like this is anything new. The position of president has in many ways, you know, expanded his platform to do all these things. But it just strikes me how now, finally, media, all kinds of people are speaking about these things, these characteristics of Trump plainly. There is no more, you know, trying to be touchy-feely, trying to be polite, trying to be quote-unquote civil. The reality is this man is a racist. He is a white supremacist. He is a misogynist. He is sexist. And he has not only he has not only become emboldened with each thing he's been able to get away with, but as Mark just said, he has completely fueled the worst inclinations in people who already have racist ideas, already have white nationalists and white supremacist ideas, and are willing to carry out all kinds of acts of terror in his name. And I wonder, when are we going to stop coddling? I don't care that he's the president. When are we going to stop coddling this person who so clearly is dangerous, not only for this country, but specifically for the people who he denigrates on a daily basis?
Well, I mean, that's going to show up. I mean, the answer might be in 2020 when we see who votes, because as Mark points out, these the people who love the racist language that he uses and for whom he speaks have voted for him already. Right.
Right.
That racist subset of the population has voted for Donald Trump. Does he get any more? Maybe not. And remember, he didn't win the majority. So then the question is, does this enrage enough people and wake up enough people who didn't vote in 2016 to vote in 2020 and turn him out?
Right.
And that's really ultimately the question.
And I think we have to be cautious about that also. I think one of the things that we've learned about Donald Trump, that people, besides the rabid followers, people who support Donald Trump often are embarrassed to say so.
That's right.
We saw that in the context of the exit polls. And in particularly in the quote-unquote, you know, the squad that he targeted, it wasn't just the fact they were women of color. There were also folks who clearly were defined on what we think of as a Democratic left at this point in time. And there are a few amount of people who, despite the racist rhetoric, find some comfort in the idea that Donald Trump represents a certain kind of stability around wealth and their wealth and capitalism that they don't trust on the American left, as represented in this case by the squad.
That's right.
And those are the folks that I worry about, particularly in the context 2 years from now, we're looking at a recession.
Right. Listen, I mean, there's a commentator who used to be in Obama's White House named Zerlina Maxwell, who has repeatedly, and I just applaud her every time she makes it plain on MSNBC, she has talked about how people are hedging. You know, they're not really showing their hand. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely what happened in 2016. All the polls were suggesting that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and clearly she did not. And the same possibility exists in 2020. When people will say one thing when they're polled, but actually go out and do another thing. So we cannot begin to believe that just because people are giving lip service to how horrible, you know, Donald Trump's racism and misogyny is and how dangerous he is, that they're not going to support him when it comes down to the wire.
Well, because they're concerned about their 401k.
That's right.
Well, but the people who were affected and who don't have 401ks, the people who may not have voted, and there were a lot of reasons for progressive voters to stay home in 2016, a lot of reasons.
Yep.
And if you wipe all that away and say, look, the stakes are too high, and for people who have been subjected too long to this and victimized for too long, whose 401ks don't look that fat at the moment, I mean, that may be the ultimate question. Who among that group shows up in large numbers and changes the equation? But in terms of how it energizes and emboldens, I mean, we'll talk about Charlotte, North Carolina, right? Let's look at that. At least 12 elected officials in Mecklenburg County received racist threatening letters. The name of Donald Trump was invoked to support the racist language in that letter. I want to hear a clip now from Mecklenburg County Commissioner Vilma Leek, who's reading a section of that letter at a recent public meeting.
And on that note, I do believe you need to go back to where you came from if you don't begin to show this great country some respect and honor. Your freedom was born on the backs of great Americans, white Americans, who fought for you. So get over it, assimilate. If not, I'm afraid that one of these days some will recognize what you really stand for or don't stand for, and will round you up and all of you and send you screaming to the concentration camps where you belong.
Mecklenburg County Commissioner Vilma Leek reading from a letter that was sent to her. At least 11 other black elected officials in Mecklenburg County received similar letters. And what she said was, look, we know that there's racist people in this county. We have not gotten letters like this before. Mm-hmm. This is new.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in bold. And again, it's violent language. It echoes the president's racist language. Go back where you came from, infested. But it also and other points in that letter also threatened violence.
You know what? Listen, and I'm sure that Mark can attest to this. One of the things that I have found to be really interesting as an instructor is that there are so many students who blindly just believe and listen to the media. And whatever the media says or whatever they hear, it doesn't even have to be the media, that's what they believe. It's not until they are confronted with the truth of the matter, when they actually have to engage with history, when they have to read something that explains what and gives context for what we're dealing with today, only at that point do they begin to see, wow, okay, I didn't realize that. I can't tell you how many times I've had young white men in my classes send me an email or come see me and say, I had no idea. Right. What can I do? And I, you know, it's laughable. It would be laughable if it weren't so dangerous what this person who wrote this letter to the Charlotte officials is saying about you need to go back where you came from, that your freedom was born on the backs of great Americans, white Americans.
White Americans who've bought your freedom.
Come on. Yeah. What have you been, do you know your history at all?
Tell you what, we'll take a break here and we'll talk to one of the people who has been essential in correcting the narrative, Toni Morrison, who passed away this month. Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. It's Back Channel on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Toni Morrison's command of language was unparalleled. She seamlessly wove history, folklore, and spirituality to compose novels that transformed the American literary landscape. Books like The Bluest Eye and Beloved are often required reading in school, but they are also books people choose to go back to again and again. Toni Morrison died last week at the age of 88, and today on Back Channel, we remember her life and legacy. Still with me, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is James B. Duke Distinguished Professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. And I want to start with a clip from Toni Morrison, the first African American woman to win a Nobel Prize in Literature. And here is a clip from her 1993 acceptance speech.
Language can never pin down slavery, genocide, war, nor should it yearn for the arrogance to be able to do so. Its force, its felicity, is in its reach toward the ineffable. Be it grand or slender, borrowing, blasting, or refusing to sanctify, whether it laughs out loud or is a cry without an alphabet, the choice word, the chosen silence, unmolested language surges toward knowledge, not its destruction. Word work is sublime, she thinks, because it's generative. It makes meaning that secures our difference, our human difference, the way in which we are like no other life.
Toni Morrison accepting the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993. We're remembering her today on Back Channel, a recurring series that connects culture and context. Natalie Bullock Brown, tell us how her word work affected you in your life.
Well, like a lot of people that I know and that I follow on social media, it seems that we all had a similar experience with Toni Morrison. She came into my life when I was 14 or 15 years old, might have been earlier, and I read The Bluest Eye. And it just had just the impact of that book on my young life at that time. I really believe in many ways set the stage for the type of work that I'm interested in and that I do today.
Did it change something in your thinking? I mean, how did it do that?
Well, I think that I mean, I loved to read. And there was, I think, something powerful about being able to read the words of a Black woman who was writing about a Black girl like me. So I was finally able to see myself in the things that I was reading about, because I had theretofore been reading Judy Blume and, you know, other series of books that were really about young white girls. But Toni Morrison opened up this world that dealt with issues that were germane to me. And that was hugely important. But because, I mean, you know, I wasn't conscious in the same way that I am now. But, you know, there was a seed planted, no doubt, that helped me to begin to sort of grapple with, you know, the things that I was thinking about at that time, which were around the beauty standard and, you know, what I look like in relationship to my many white classmates. And and her work continued to impact me all the way up to, I think it was Jazz. It was at that point I was like, okay, you lost me, Toni. I can't go with you no more. But, you know, it was also just where I was at the time as a young 20-something. So she's hugely impactful, hugely impactful.
Mark, what was your first encounter with her work?
It was much later. It was in grad school. I didn't read The Bluest Eye as a kid. And I understand why in many ways, because that's not necessarily the kind of book that my parents would have driven towards my way. I actually became much more familiar with Morrison in terms of a nonfiction, specifically the collection of essays, Plain After Dark, where she talked about notions of whiteness. What was always the most fascinating part to me about Toni Morrison's story was her career in life before becoming a novelist, working as a book editor in New York, the fact that she was Angela Davis's editor. When Angela Davis did her first couple of books. And so to think about someone, you know, who had enough skill and confidence in their own skill to be able to nurture other people's writings until it was her time, right, to be able to do what she did. And I can still remember the excitement around the Nobel Prize in 1993, you know, what it meant for African-American literature, establishing it, if it hadn't been understood as such at the time, as a legitimate field, the way that she was often a beyond the fray in the conversations around African-American literature, particularly between Black men and Black women writers, the battles between Alice Walker and Ishmael Reed, for instance. Mm-hmm. She was above that fray. And she had a kind of, you know, presence about her that was so important. I only met her one time. I was asked to give a lecture at Princeton by my friend Daphne Brooks. And the classroom that we used for the lecture, Toni Morrison taught in right before. Mm-hmm. So she was still lingering in the classroom. And what surprised me more than anything is that she was tiny.
Mm. That's so interesting.
And it's like the fact that she had created these immense worlds and worlds that aren't so easily translated. I mean, the one piece of her work that, you know, that we know in terms of being something else in terms of beloved, you know, her work was always already cinematic.
Yeah.
Right. So it didn't even make sense to depict it in cinematic ways.
Yeah. I just think about listening to her part of the acceptance speech from the Nobel Peace Prize in 93. I was just struck by the fact that, you know, Toni Morrison was an amazing writer, but part of what made her so amazing was her keen understanding of all the things that she talked about. Like, she understood Black people, she understood Black culture, she understood politics, she understood white supremacy and racism. She totally got underneath those things, right? And she was able to talk about them in ways that resonated with a 14-year-old, mm-hmm. you know, let alone an adult. But also, I think, you know, she, to me, speaks to something that is so interesting to me when we, as I get older and we begin to lose people who were so central to my upbringing. You know, when Prince died, people were talking about, we need to shrink wrap Stevie Wonder so that we don't lose him, you know, but Toni Morrison is someone we needed to shrink wrap. It never occurred to me that someone like her could, was, you know, vulnerable. to mortality, you know? And I think what Mark was talking about in terms of her being so small and tiny when she seems so large. I mean, I can't even imagine seeing her and she seeming diminutive right. in any way, right? But I just think that she her presence, her intellectual prowess is something that we need to preserve and hold on to and lift up because we are such an anti-intellectual right. culture.
right.
And
right.
she was, you know, she did not shrink away from that. And it really gave the rest of us permission in many ways to embrace that as well.
In plain everyday speak, that when she was not Toni Morrison novelist and just talking about her work, and again, we've been blessed with those who have been able to see the documentary about her. It's like this great gift of who she is, you know, at this moment and, you know, at the end of her life. But the way she had ability to kind of, for lack of a better way to describe it, to cut through the crap. And I still
right.
I still live to this day with an interview that she did with Charlie Rose around the time that she won the Nobel Prize. And she talks about being, you know, we live in a world now, because she was thinking about how to deal with black men. And she's like, we live in a world now where you can't be a man and not have money. Right.
Uh-huh.
And that challenges what black masculinity looks like for
yeah.
us at this period of time.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And I've lived with that idea now for like 18, 28 years.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And she was very much like Baldwin also in terms of her ability to just distill down to its essence what racism is about and how it's needed in many ways by white society. Because when you don't have that, when you have not reduced other people in such a way to uplift yourself, like where does that leave you? You know, who are you? What do you become?
Yeah, no, it's a foundation. And you don't have the United States of America without white racism and white supremacy. So what do? You pull that block out and you got some other country.
Right.
And that's the thing that people have hard time. And for guys like James Baldwin and I think perhaps even Toni Morrison, it's like, yeah, there you are.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why at least Baldwin and I don't know so much about Toni Morrison in terms of her sense of optimism or pessimism. You know, can we get out of
right.
this? Baldwin was very clear. That's not my job. You all figured this out. But talk more about, let's talk about this idea of transcendence. You say she was above the fray. But in what way and where does she fit in this whole question of black literature and you know, race-conscious literature and also a writer, Mark? How does she navigate that?
I just simply her talent was so above the fray that she was someone who couldn't be reduced to a camp
mm-hmm.
amongst American writers, amongst African-American writers, amongst women writers. The work just simply spoke for itself. And the Nobel Prize kind of was a
yeah.
testament to that.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about that Charlie Rose interview, and Charlie Rose sort of quoted to her critics who were saying, you know, about her work on race, and is she, you know, a race writer, and when will she stop writing about race, right? And so she talks about that in answering a question because, you know, she was asked, you know, when she would incorporate white lives into her novels to show that she had kind of finally matured as a writer, and here is her answer on that.
I've spent my entire writing life trying to make sure that the white gaze was not the dominant one in any of my books. My sovereignty and my authority as a racialized person had to be struck immediately with the very first book. And it was strange because in this country, many books, particularly then, 40s, 50s, you could feel the address of the narrator over my shoulder. Talking to somebody else, talking to somebody white. I could tell because they're explaining things that they didn't have to explain if they were talking to me.
Toni Morrison in a 1998 interview with Charlie Rose talking about her answer to a question that a journalist had once posed to her, can you imagine writing a novel not centered around race? Talking to Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown.
And you know what? That interview is with a white woman. I think she's a BBC reporter. I can't remember.
Jenna Wendt, I think. Jenna Wendt, yeah.
And like, come through, Toni, because she says in no uncertain terms, just the fact that you're asking me that question is racist. Right. And I think that that is part of what I love and really brought me back to Toni Morrison as I got older was the fact that, as Mark said, she didn't mince words. She just got right to the point and left you there. You know, either you deal with what she's saying or you do whatever ninja moves you're going to do to avoid it. But, you know, she was straight up. And you know, it, I think what she talks about in that quote about, you know, that narrator, like, over her shoulder, right, speaking to someone white, you know, I think that anybody, it's something that I've had to grapple with, like, who is my audience? Right. Who am I talking to? Who am I trying to appeal to? I think anybody who deals with art, whether it be literature, film, whatever it may be, has to grapple with that question. And she lays it bare and makes it very plain that, look, I am a racialized artist, and this is what I have to think about, but this is not about you. This is not about you, white folks. This is about who I'm trying to talk to.
Yeah. Is she among the first writers, black writers, to do that, Mark, to say, look, I'm going to abandon that at the risk of losing maybe a subset of an audience?
I think you go back to the Black Nationalist Movement and the Black Culture Movement in 1960, someone like a Baraka. I think they clearly were not interested in what white folks thought about the work. But I think she's the one who had the kind of massive mainstream appeal and success doing that in ways that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah. Much of her work is, of course, preoccupied with history, as seen through the eyes of a particular character in her novel. Often that character is a woman. Natalie, give us a sense of some of the black women characters in her work and how they stand out for you.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Well, Sethi, absolutely, from Beloved, you know, stands out in my mind just because of the, you know, the trauma and the horrific experience that she has in trying to, like, protect her children just to start off, just for starters. I cannot remember the main character in The Bluest Eye, but... I feel like her last name is Bledsoe, but the fact that she is a young person, you know, grappling with these things, like, to the point that she is, you know, wishes she could pluck her eyes out and replace them, you know, with blue eyes, is you know, memorable. It's just a moment in that book, in The Bluest Eye, that I will never forget. I can't even, I mean, there's, thank you. What's her name? Pecola. Thank you. Yes, Pecola Breedlove. Breedlove, from The Bluest Eye. I cannot remember the characters from Sula, but I mean, I all I can say is that there is a way that Toni Morrison, even though in many ways as a teenager, her language went above my head, I also could, it resonated with me. And it's a very interesting sort of experience when you don't necessarily know all the words and aren't on the same level as the intellectual that is writing to you or writing for you, but you get it somehow, you know? And I think that is, that's an amazing gift that Toni Morrison had.
And it's an important question, because I think about, since the publication of The Bluest Eye, the generations of 14-year-old black girls,
yes,
who read that book and what kind of impact it had on their lives, that it wouldn't have happened if Toni Morrison hadn't written it. Had Toni Morrison been writing for a white audience,
right,
that's not the book she would have written.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
I want to play a clip now from a more recent interview of Toni Morrison, a conversation between her and Terry Gross on Fresh Air. This is 2015, talking about her novel God Help the Child, which is the last book she published in her lifetime, addresses colorism. Terry asked Toni, were there times in your life when you were exposed to that kind of hierarchy of color within and the African-American community? And here's what she says.
I have. I didn't have it until I went away to college. I didn't know there was this kind of preference. But I noticed, in addition to the outside world of Washington, D.C., which at that time, this is 1949, 1950, there were very obvious stated written differences between what white people were able to do and what black people were able to do. But on the campus where I felt safe and welcome, I began to realize that this idea of the lighter, the better, and the darker, the worse, was really had an impact on sororities, on friendships, on all sorts of things. And it was stunning to me.
Toni Morrison talking to Terry Gross in 2015. We should point out the campus she's talking about is Howard University,
yes.
Right? So, yeah. And that's where she went. So how do you think her work has evolved then? The sense of maybe her as a professional, her ability to speak to some of these other issues, but also maybe her thinking and her writing how over her career, Mark, would you say?
I think the best testament is that I can't imagine there's going to be anything less than 36 Toni Morrison seminars that are going to be offered this fall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, 24 of which were already going to be offered, right, regardless of whether or not she had passed at this period of time.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a richness and a legacy there. Someone who, you know, has not only filled the space but created new spaces because of how massive her impact has been and her influence has been. I'd be hard-pressed to think about another Black literary figure that first has had the longevity that she had, was productive in the context of longevity, because while Baldwin, you know, had a particularly fiery moment of time, you know, it wasn't as consistently, you know, the same way. The fact that she was still writing, you know, late in the game, you know, spoke to how important, you know, it was for her. I know my colleagues at Princeton, you know, loved the fact that they were able to have her there, you know, and be such a fixture. I taught at State University of New York, Albany, early in my career where she was, and they didn't know what to do with Toni Morrison.
Sure they didn't.
They did not know what to do with Toni
Morrison. Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, back channel on The State of Things. We'll continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio on Back Channel today, a recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Let's turn now and talk about the photo archive of Ebony and Jet magazines, which went up for auction in July. Close to 4 million photographs documenting fashion, the civil rights movement, and major moments in American history. Mark, tell us more about the story of this auction.
So, you know, Ebony Magazine, which was a, you know, mainstay in terms of African-American homes and life, really the Black Life magazine, if you will, for those who don't know what Life magazine was. And so it had this rich archive. In fact, you know, when the editorial content of Ebony and Jet was a little crazy. You know, there were some great moments when Lerone Bennett was editor and doing some great work, but it wasn't always great content. The best part of the project was always their photography archive, particularly the classic stuff. And once Ebony went under, the question is, what do we do with this archive? And, you know, there's a way in which we often hope that with things like this, Black institutions will step in and take over the archive. I'm sure a bunch of folks, well, let's Jay-Z and Beyonce buy the archive. And it's like, okay, and they buy the archive,
right.
And what are they going to do?
Right,
they put
exactly.
it in the basement in one of their houses. And I'm sure we were hoping that some Black institutions and Black philanthropy would step in. But what ended up happening was, you know, four foundations, two of which that are run by African-Americans, Darren Walker at the Ford Foundation and Elizabeth Alexander at the Mellon Foundation, who apparently was the person who pulled all this together, you know, brought together Getty and another foundation. It's like, let's buy this archive and then make it available to both Getty and also the National African-American Museum. So that it can actually be the kind of resource that it needs to be going forward. You wish there was a point in time where Ebony could have monetized it.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a way to be able to sustain itself.
Exactly.
But in the absence of that, the fact that you've had African Americans at major foundations who understood the value of the archive in ways that might not have been the case 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. Who could pull this together and bring it to Black institutions and make it available to the folks. It's a remarkable story.
Yeah.
And a remarkable story to keep American history as well. That
absolutely.
This is something we all need, but certainly an important part of African-American history, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, when I think about Ebony and Jet, you know, and the role that these publications played in my upbringing, there was a time where I was just like, I just felt like, you know, they were the ghetto. You know, this is where, you know, this is where, these are the magazines that I read because I'm black, right? And this is like what's available because I'm black, right? But there's Elle and there's Cosmopolitan, there's all these other, you know, 17 and what have you that are more appealing. It is in my, you know, later years that I have realized the wealth of culture and just history that exists within those publications, but certainly the archives. And I feel a little verklempt, I would say, that HBCUs couldn't come together. And it's not their fault. I mean, they don't have the resources. They don't have the infrastructure to take care of an archive like the Ebony Jet Archives. But that's where I would have loved to have seen this wealth of material, you know, fall.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because, of course, John H. Johnson founded that, and he talked about the importance of reflecting. There was a black press at the time, which talked a lot about the trials and tribulations and hardship of being black, and that was important, he understood, but there was nothing that, in his mind, reflected sort of day-to-day life. That was what he will say was the founding principle behind Ebony. And now let's listen to a clip from John Johnson, who is talking about the photo archive and its importance in the civil rights movement.
I think we played an important role, because in the beginning, Martin Luther King Jr. was leading marches, and the white press were ignoring the marches. So he called up Bob Johnson and said, "Bob, you know, they're ignoring us down here. Tell your boss I want him to send you and the best photographer down to cover such and such an event, and it would be helpful if you cover all of the events." So we covered that event, and we covered all of the events. We, even when it was very hostile in Mississippi, we would hire a white photographer to go down and take the pictures of the white people, and a black photographer to go down and take pictures of the black people. And then the white photographer and the black photographer would meet at night and exchange views and things. Yeah. So it was very important, and we prided ourselves on going wherever.
That's a clip from the oral history interview with John Johnson, the publisher and founder of Ebony and Jet Magazines, archived in the National Visionary Leadership Project. Talking to Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. I mean, that's something that is sort of hard for us to understand or remember, for those of us who remember, because at least racial affairs get coverage these days. Right. And there was a time when, absolutely, especially in the Southern press, you couldn't even get a mister if you did get named in the press, but you certainly, these movements were simply not being covered.
I mean, you think about pre-Watts, you know, newsrooms, before newsrooms began to be integrated, you know, without Ebony and the Chicago Defender, the Amsterdam News and other newspapers like this, the Baltimore Afro-American, you know, where were black journalists going to, you know, earn their chops, right? Where are they going to learn how to be photojournalists? We wouldn't have a teeny one shot. You know, Hodges without, you know, that particular opportunity. Ernest Withers, even though he was on the FBI's payroll, you know, they were great opportunities. And the fact that, you know, the Emmett Till photo of the open casket. I mean, that in the most tragic moment might be the crowning moment of how important it was to have our own independent black press, because the New York Times wasn't going to publish that.
That's right.
Well, let's turn now to talk about a new television drama, Pose, on FX, created by Ryan Murphy. It depicts ballroom culture in New York City in the 1980s, features a record number of trans actors. Mark, let me stick with you for just a minute and tell us a bit more about the premise.
You know, it's, if you think about taking Paris is Burning and putting it in a weekly series, and getting a more interpersonal interaction with the men and the women who were part of ballroom culture in New York, you know, something that was so important to the wide culture of New York City in the late 1980s and early 1990s, that then gets reduced to Madonna's Vogue and a few other moments like Paris is Burning.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful to get a kind of narrative history. And again, if there's a person who kind of really drives this in the public imagination now, is Billy Porter.
Absolutely.
You know, Billy Porter, who went from being, you know, a almost traditional Broadway performer 20 years ago, recording R&B albums, right, who then has this great breakthrough with Kinky Boots, And now is known for him showing up on the red carpet. And of course, he got many nominations last year for his role, you know, in Pose. I think the wonderful moment, the wonderful thing about this moment with so many different platforms to be able to tell stories is that we can now tell really detailed historical narratives about what was happening in the period of time that we still don't quite understand, right? We don't understand what New York City really right. looked like during the AIDS epidemic in those early years, and how even as it was a time of death, it was a time in which folks were building and sustaining communities at the same time.
And I think it's very important that something like Pose exists in this moment, culturally, politically, and otherwise, because we know that there are, you know, just an incredible amount of trans deaths, especially trans women of color, that exist and that are often completely underreported. So this runs counter to this, you know, horrible undercurrent of these murders that don't really get any attention. And here's the celebration of right. trans life in a way that I don't think we've ever seen. And certainly if we've seen it, I mean, Paris is Burning is certainly one way that we saw it, what, 20, almost 30 years ago. Right. But it was still quite, I think, stereotypical. The right. framing was, you know, not quite authentic.
Well, it's that over-the-shoulder business. It's yes. as though I'm having to explain the things. And in some ways, this is meant for the people who get it. And if you want to follow along, because it's visually stunning and yeah. the acting is fabulous, so yeah. why not? But a lot of it is you know, we have trans actors in this. Let's get just a little sample, and we'll play a clip from episode 2 of the first season, when the trans character Blanca is with another trans friend trying to get served at a gay bar.
You don't like women in here. This is a gay bar.
Well, I want to see a manager.
Girl, why you always gotta pick fights you can't win?
Because these are the ones worth fighting.
I'm Mitchell, the manager. Can we speak outside where it's quieter?
How could you discriminate against me in my own community?
This bar is called Boy Lounge. We have a specific clientele. Gay, under 35.
White?
Frankly, yes. The New York City nightlife is segregated. Look, I've got a friend. She works at the Cubbyhole. I'll call her. You guys can go. You can drink free all night.
But I don't want that scene tonight.
I'm sorry. I'm not throwing a costume party.
Oh, this is not over. It was over before it started. Everybody needs someone to make them feel superior. That line ends with us, though. Runs downhill past the women, the blacks, Latins, gays, until it reaches the bottom and lands on our kind.
An episode from the FX show Pose, streaming on Netflix now. I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal.
I mean, I can't really say much more. I think that quote, especially at the end, is, you know, perfectly encapsulates the issue, which is that there are all these misunderstandings of what it even means to be trans and whether or not a trans woman is actually a woman and so forth. But then also this hierarchy, this social hierarchy that exists. You know, I think even black people, even black women often miss the fact that even though we're real low down here, right underneath us are trans women. And that is something that we as a culture, we as a community have to confront, because the humanity of everyone is under assault now. So we cannot afford to, you know, dismiss the humanity of anybody in this moment.
And trans actress Angelica Ross, who stars in this new FX show, Pose, just finished the second season. She was asked whether or not, you know, it's important for trans actors to play trans roles. And she made, a subtle point and a subtle nuanced point in whether or not you need to be a trans actor to play this. Let's listen to what she said.
I actually am not against cis people playing trans roles. I'm all for the craft of acting. You know, what's hurtful is when you have portrayals like, you know, when you have someone like Jared Leto who accepts an award for, like, Dallas Buyers Club after playing a trans woman standing in a full beard and, you know, looking fully cis male, it is communicating to our audiences that underneath all of that, It's still a man under that. And I feel like oftentimes with casting directors and directors that I've spoken with, myself and many other trans actors have been denied the opportunity because they tell us that we don't look trans enough.
Trans actress Angelica Ross, starring in the new FX show Pose, now in its second season, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. I mean, this gets to the subtlety of representation, but the importance, as you said, the idea of having, you know, going back to the Ebony Archive, having African-American people or directors of foundations in a position to understand the importance of that. Having representation counts.
I mean, that's why having a figure like Janet Mock on the scene these days is important, right? Someone who could help. You know, as a gatekeeper, you know, to be able to craft the kind of storytelling that needs to be done and representation needs to be done. You know, the idea that a character does not, a person doesn't look trans enough.
Right.
And how many black actors have been told you're not black enough? How
Thank
many
you.
Latino right. actors have right. been told you're not Latino enough, right?
Right.
By folks who have no idea.
Right.
On what
well, they
enough.
Do. They do have an idea, and it's their idea.
Right.
And that's
right.
the point.
Right.
It's you got to be my idea yeah. of black, right. and guess
right.
who
right.
I am.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what? To that point, it makes me think about, I'm going to take it back to Birth of a Nation, to D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, and the way that he had white men play black men
right.
so that he could best depict his idea
exactly.
of what black
exactly.
men are about, right?
Right.
And it's still going on. That's crazy.
All right, I left very little time for this, Mark, to save you. Family Reunion, the Netflix sitcom, controversial around this place, I will tell you. Let's play Family Reunion. It's running on Netflix, and why don't we play a little bit from the trailer to give you a sample?
Some banana pudding.
Yes, yes.
Banana pudding? I love you way more than my other grandma.
Ah, Shaka, stop, stop.
Well, Jade, you're the same color as this pudding.
Leave your sister alone. Black people come in all shades and we're all beautiful.
Yeah. Jade just takes more after my mother.
Yeah, but Grandma Daffy is white.
Yeah. And she's still darker than you.
Y'all better stop teasing Jade. You gonna need her to help you get a cab someday.
Now, a clip from the first episode of the new Netflix sitcom Family Reunion. That was the colorism episode, and each one is very, very clearly categorized. Mark, would you think this is something we should watch? Tell us more.
So, you know, it's something that was brought together by Meg DeLoach, a veteran television writer, got her start on Family Matters. And if you watch Family Reunion, you can see a kind of lineage there. It stars Tia Mowry, who we know for Sister Sister, and of course, the great Loretta Devine, who's been a wonderful character actor for, you know, 30, 40 years now. And what strikes me is about this, you know, you have a black showrunner, you have an all-black writing room. And the question begs the answer, you know, what's the audience for this? And I think there are times, I think both audiences and also critics are subjected to this. We get caught up in, I think, the coolness of some of the things that we watch. It is not blackish, right?
No, it's
it is not.
Not.
I mean, the same way that we could think about how different we thought about Family Matters and the Cosby Show, mm-hmm. you know, even 20 years ago, it's not that. And it's deeply embedded in kind of Southern black Christian values, right? And what I've learned, you know, by shows like this is that there is an audience for that. It's the same audience that supported Tyler Perry in the early days. And the fact that, you know, it was in fact my 16-year-old, right, who listened to trap music, who brought it to my attention. And, you know, my late grandmother was an itinerant preacher. I can't imagine a television show that my 16-year-old, myself, my mother, and my grandmother would have sat down and watched. This is like the only show I could ever imagine the four of them could have sat down together. And I think that's what's important about the show, right? And, you know, the writing is uneven. Right. There's some great moments. There's some bad. Towards the end of the first season, there's actually some extraordinary moments. Right. And again, you got veteran actors like Richard Roundtree, you know, who's also in the mix. So the writing is not there. The craft, if you will, is not there. But the idea of a family sitting around watching a television show again. This, I think, is an attempt to do that.
Natalie, out of time.
Saved by the bell.
Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, back channel on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.